session, this class is on St. Francis and the church, continuing our series on Francis as a model for human liberation. Yesterday we looked at Francis in relation to the poor, and tomorrow we will look at Francis in relation to how we as a people recover a sense of the feminine, and on Saturday we look at Francis in relation to human suffering. But tonight the subject of our discussion will be Francis in relation to the church. What we've been trying to do all week is to use bits and pieces of Francis's biography as a springboard for our common theological reflection around different issues that face us. We're using Francis's biography as a springboard for theological reflection around issues of that face us as men and women of faith in the 20th century. I wanted to make an announcement, though. Some of you have expressed interest in pursuing the possibility of showing the film Brother, Son, Sister Moon that we thought we might have here in the village, and apparently no one's been able to track it down. So, unfortunately, we won't be able to show that. The movie was about St. Francis, and if they track it down, they'll let me know, but they haven't been able to find it so far, so it doesn't look promising for that. Again, we will try tonight to, I'll try to kind of lay out some material, and then we'll having some time for a small group discussion and hopefully some more experiential kinds of things to kind of give us a balance in our evening. I think it's been interesting how much time we have spent looking at the Francis's conversion experience, because I think in that experience we get a lot of important clues about who Francis was and what he is trying, what he can teach us about radical discipleship. It's very similar as well to the prophets. And if you look at the prophets' call experience, generally at the beginning of each of the books of the prophets, if you look in the early chapters, you'll have a discrete call experience in which the prophet is commissioned by Yahweh to go about prophecy. And in that call experience, you can decipher very important clues about the whole ministry of that prophet, whether it be Jeremiah or Isaiah or Ezekiel, or from that one beginning point. And I think the same is true for Francis, that if we look at his conversion, we get very important clues about who he is and what he can teach us. You remember we talked about this in the first session, particularly when we kind of did an overview of Francis's biography. You remember the vision in which he heard the words, "Behold, my church is in ruins; rebuild my house." And Francis took this vision, these words from God, in a very literal sense, of repairing a ruined chapel outside of Assisi called San Damiano. And he went about, his first efforts to do that were, he went and stole some of his father's goods. His father was a cloth merchant, and took those goods and sold them on the market, and took the money, and then went and bought building materials for this chapel. Then, later on, he went about begging for stones so that he could repair this ruined chapel. In a very literal sense, he responded to this call, but in a more symbolic and profound way, this was the essence of Francis's whole ministry and his life vocation, was the rebuilding of the church, the renewal of the church. We recalled in the first session how in Francis's age was an age of 1,001 splinter movements, charismatic schismatic groups that had a particular insight or experience and splintered off from the church and went to extremes to reestablish a truth that had somehow been lost in the mainstream church. Francis, some, and all the Franciscans somehow withstood that temptation to break off from the church and form a separate community. They always, even though there was some tension with the church, they were certainly a renewal movement that was challenging the church to its core, and yet they never questioned that that was where they belonged, and that this was ultimately Francis's life vocation, was to bring renewal to the church from within, to bring about a revolution of values from within the institutional church. And so he invested an awful lot of energy and effort into his relationships with the Vatican, with the Bishop in Assisi, and all the Franciscans as they went out into Europe always were required to check in with the local religious authorities and officials before they went about their work. So I think this is where our beginning point is in our discussion about Francis in relation to the church, is this very important aspect of his conversion experience. See that my church is in ruins, rebuild my church. This was the initial, very literal impetus for his beginning of his work and his life. Of all the texts that are powerful symbols in Scripture of the church, the people of God, Israel, the body of Christ, none is so important to Francis as the following text that I'd like to read to you. Remember, we talked about three texts that were very, very important to Francis. The one that we mentioned yesterday was the story of the rich young ruler and his encounter with Jesus. This is the story of the mission, the commissioning of the 12 disciples. And he called to him the 12 and began to send them out two by two and gave them authority over the unclean spirits. Each charged them to take nothing for their journey except a staff, no bread, no bag, no money in their belts, but to wear sandals and not put on two tunics. And Jesus said to them, "When you enter a house, stay there until you leave the place. And if any place will not receive you, and they refuse to hear you, when you leave, shake off the dust that is on your feet for a testimony against them." So the 12 went out and preached that men and women should repent, and they cast out many demons and anointed with oil many that were sick and healed them. What strikes you about that text? What immediately kind of jumps out about that?
How very independent the followers were to be in terms of planning. Clear objective.
You know, that is a very interesting observation, because that's always struck me when I read this text, that these apostles were commissioned to be traveling about the country on their own, denying themselves. It's a very ascetic picture. You'd have to be a very tough, an independent person to follow this mission, be a part of this mission. And yet what I'm hearing more of now as I read it over and over again and reflect on the life of Francis is the system of hospitality that undergirds this mission. We kind of focus on what they're supposed to go without. You know, they're not supposed to have any anything for the journey except a staff, no bread, no bag, no money in their belts, but to wear sandals and not put on two tunics, a very ascetic picture. And yet, is that asceticism so that we can be tough and prove how independent we are? Or is that dependency and openness and vulnerability to others and to people who would take us in and extend hospitality to us? It's almost exactly the opposite of what you and I have focused on, in the sense of ascetics who can do without anything and don't need anybody. It's almost that these disciples were sent out and were dependent and absolutely dependent on hospitality and community. Yeah.
That's what I was going to say. I would see that as being a total dependence, also a reliance on guidance from God and what they're doing, because it's sort of like you are putting your, you know, they're still humans and you still need basic needs of life. And so it isn't that a lot of those things that they cannot do without, but it's a matter of, like you said, the acceptance of hospitality from others and knowing that that community and that support is going to be there and relying on that direction.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And it struck me how different the church works today, being so much more established.
That's right. And the whole movement toward professional ministry and mm-hmm. and there's good in that, and there's also we lose sight of other things, I think. Well, this text is very important. If there are three texts in the Bible that really define who Francis is, this is one of them. And I think it's very important to, if this really defines what Francis' understanding of the apostolic community, of the community of faith, then we see that unlike the contemporary church that has mission as one aspect of its life alongside of education and worship and nurture and everything else, the church was mission for Francis. The church was the very reason and essential reason for the church was to fulfill a mission. And that's something I think mission has somehow become a department of the church today, that some of us tend to, and we have our mission committees and we have a season for mission, but we've lost that sense of primacy that Francis had in reading this text and in living out this text and his ministry, that the church was mission. I want to describe, if we could be, say we were all graduate students in sociology and we could go back in a time machine and get the chance to just look at Francis's community, and we could do some research and interviews and just very descriptive way, just describe what Francis's initial original community looked like. That's what I'd kind of like for us to do a little bit. And I want to put these up on the board because I think there's some very important qualities that were embodied in the early Franciscan community and how he tried to live out and act out his vision of the church, the community of faith, the community of Christ. The first is that his community was drawn from across class lines. You remember his first two converts or followers, Bernardo and Peter, the first two men who joined with Francis. One was a rich businessman, the other was a high-placed official in the church, and yet soon after that, and the most dominant recruit among the Franciscans were very, very poor people. And so you had a remarkable community in that it grew from every sector across socioeconomic lines that were very much absolute lines. And that, I mean, if you had a stratified society, ever, it was in Italy in that century, And so to the creation of a community that broke apart those distinctions was a remarkable thing. I know as a Presbyterian, it's for many Presbyterians, it's a cause for questioning and a haunting sense of what we are really about as Presbyterians, because we tend to be such a upper middle class community. And a lot of Presbyterians sense that we are losing something because we do not have people of lower income or people of color who strongly represented in our community. And I don't know, perhaps there are Lutherans who feel the same way about the Lutheran community. But this was definitely a cross-mixing in the Franciscan community of people from different class situations. The second important characteristic was that it was a very egalitarian community. Francis, this is one of the little contradictions in Francis's character which will allow him. He was very much the leader and the founder of this order, and yet at the same time he resisted till the nth degree the creation of any head brothers or bosses or people who were really in charge of the order. He felt that would be a serious compromise of his community to create any kind of hierarchy. And so even though he himself exercised enormous authority and influence over the direction of the community, he exercised that authority to the degree that he tried to eliminate any kind of hierarchy or offices of authority. The third characteristic is one that I think we're all aware of, the radical detachment from material possessions. It was, Francis took this so very far that even brothers in the order rebelled against his commitment to poverty because it was so extreme. One time someone asked him why he was so against any kind of possessions, and he said, well, once we have possessions, we'll need arms and law to defend them. He knows that power and law are always used to protect what we have. And that's I heard an interesting definition of poverty the other day. Spiritual poverty is when we have nothing left to protect. And that what we feel like we have to protect is really our wealth that separates us from God. The fourth characteristic that I want to bring out is their presence among the poor. This radical detachment from material possessions was not simply an ascetic program, but it was meant as a way of releasing people and qualifying them to take their place among poor people, to serve and minister to them. We remember that Francis was first ministry was to lepers, and he built a little lean-to on the side of a leper house, and he and his two comrades served and bound their wounds. Becoming poor to be with the poor. Remember, some of you remember who were at the session yesterday. We talked about the shift that occurred in the history of the church, becoming when the church first was moving out into the world. It was a church of poor people primarily. Paul's churches were dominated by lower income people. Jesus's followers were all drawn from lower income. But as the church became more and more moving from the periphery to the center and became the center of power in Constantine's empire, then the church's viewpoint became not that of the poor, but of the rich and of those in power. And that was a very, very important shift So Francis's community relinquished their material possessions in order to be able to truly be with the poor. The other is, characteristic is out of the cloister and into the marketplace. This was an order, unlike so many, that took to the streets. Their work was in the fields alongside the laborers. It was in the marketplace. It was in the common hubbub of life. There was not a sense of trying to withdraw themselves from society in order to achieve some kind of purity or sanctity that could be achieved only in a monastery. The sixth characteristic that I want to bring to your attention is that they worked for their fare. They would, they were in a sense beggars, but they would exchange physical labor for food, and or they would only. And Francis was very insistent on this, that they would never accept anything except with returning something. Reliance on hospitality. Another characteristic is their ministry of peacemaking. Franciscans were often involved in settling, mediating conflicts between business and labor, between towns, between different factions within a religious community. They were often involved and brought in, called in to help bring about some kind of nonviolent resolution. They also very early articulated in their order an injunction about ever carrying any arms. That they were a pacifist community. Number eight, they were they tried to achieve a balance between the activist and the contemplative. The famous Mount Alvernia was donated to the Franciscans, where Francis received a stigmata. There was a kind of a honeycomb of caves and little huts that they built on top of this mountain that was donated to the order by this rich duke. I'm not sure why Francis accepted this. Maybe at some point others had prevailed on over him and convinced him to accept this. But anyway, they often went there for retreats. There were they would spend days in the woods around San Damiano and Portiuncola, the other chapel where they live, in prayer, in solitude. So there was this a very natural balance between contemplation, the life of prayer, and their activity out in the world. The ninth characteristic was accepting the authority of the church. This was very, very, there was never any question that Francis was a part of the Roman Catholic community, but it didn't come easy for him, because every time he went to Rome, he was able to achieve the blessing of the Pope on this new order, but it cost him. He had to compromise his ideals, his original vision of the community. He had to water it down, the Pope and those who were in consultation with him felt it was too austere, too extreme. And so Francis was, and I guess all of us, like Francis has learned what all of us have learned, that to be in the church is to be about compromise. The tenth and last and perhaps the most important, I need to mention up here, it's primarily a lay movement. There were clerics that abandoned their positions to join Francis, but it was primarily lay people. And then later on, there was the third movement that was established, where the third order, where married folk who basically had certain circumstances they were obligated to or felt responsible or accountable to, like family and business and land, could stay in those circumstances and yet practice a modified or qualified form of the Franciscan discipline. The last characteristic I wanted to draw to your attention, inclusive of both genders. You remember the famous story of Claire, who was a nobleman's daughter of Assisi, who secretly went to have conversations with Francis, and over time began came to the point where she decided she wanted to join the order, and she snuck out of her home. It was like what do you call it when you sneak away to get married?
Elopement.
Yeah, that's right. She dressed up as a bride and snuck out of the house through a window, and with Franciscan brothers aiding her, and it came to the village, to the chapel where they lived. And a lot of things happened, but the end of it was that they established a separate order, the Sisters of Poor Claire, where women could pursue the Franciscan way in real equality with the brothers. They were separate but equal. These are some of the characteristics that have really impressed me or stood out to me about this early Franciscan community. I wonder, as you look at these and think about them, which of these characteristics seem to you to be the most challenging, the most difficult for the contemporary church to embody or to incarnate in our life?
Three
and four. Why do you say that? Who said that?
I'm trying to think why. Because for me personally, that would be the hardest thing for me to give up. Not in the sense of greed, but in the sense of security.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it would be really hard for the church to
have control.
And risk-taking.
And risk-taking. So the security of...
I would say five.
Why would you say that?
I would say five because it's more comfortable to be at Holden Village than it is to be out doing evangelism in a community of non-Christians or people that you just don't know.
Five is, those you can't read, is out of the cloister and into the marketplace. It's almost, again, the whole question of we like to stay in our comfort zones that we were talking about yesterday, and moving out of the cloister, out of our comfort zone, into the marketplace, where we're not as comfortable, where we're not as welcome. That's a tough one.
I would say four, because once you become poor, then you lose power. And the way that we tend to resolve things is from a power base. If you don't have the power, then you can't help the poor. And if you're poor, then you don't have the power, and you can't help the poor.
This is a very difficult one. We don't want to romanticize poverty and somehow say that's the answer if we just let go of our goods and we'll somehow be more Christian. But there is a sense in which we become captive to the things we have, and it narrows our choices. About our vocation, our ministry as people of faith, because we have such an accumulation of goods that once we thought were luxuries, but now seem to be more necessities.
I think that one also should be considered in relation to celibacy, and the whole question of family and responsibilities with others versus one's commitment from home, which he made, evidently is important.
Uh-huh. What else?
Is
this is a tough one for my community. The Presbyterian community has long been tied closely to the military. And it's very, very controversial for us to talk about taking resistance stances to.
Basically, they were saying from left to right, people are rallying behind President Bush at this time and sending up to 100,000 troops in that area. Mm-hmm. And what that would mean in terms of from a pacifist perspective, if we take seriously the challenge of St. Francis about times like this.
Or even just a peacemaking perspective, not that we're all pacifists, but even to be about seriously holding up the witness of peace in a situation, and yet it seems that, as you said, with this recent military intervention, we just kind of roll over and say, well, we're with the president.
Sometimes, if you don't include justice in there, peace with justice, you come to the position that the only way of achieving peace is to give up your ideals or your goals. So how does that fit in? Was he willing to kind of back off in order to make peace? Do you know the question I'm asking?
Try again.
Sometimes in order to keep peace, it's easier to just go along with an idea that you don't believe in or you think is right, because at least you haven't rocked the boat or ruffled the waters. And in the long run, I don't think that's very helpful, and it's not true to yourself. So peacemaking, when just calling it peace without saying peace with justice.
I see what you're saying. You're keeping peace and making peace are two huge, the verbs are very important. I think keeping peace most of the time translates out to maintain the status quo, mm-hmm. and making sure that everybody is kind of comfortable. Making peace often means the opposite. It means the status quo has inherent in it some injustice. Someone is excluded, and it means saying we can't be comfortable with this. So I would classify Francis, even though his justice agenda was not the same as what we mean by doing justice. Mm-hmm. I don't think there's some differences there, but I would say that he was not the pacifier in his peacemaking. Anything but.
I find number one to be the most challenging of all. 25 years ago, Gibson Winter wrote a book called The Suburban Captivity of the Church, and I still think that book is true. We are so captive to economics, and our religious organizations, even in our inner city churches, they do such a poor job of really, truly being one with people doing economics. I'm convinced that economics is much more segregation and racial segregation in America.
Mm-hmm. It was interesting to me for those of you who weren't with us yesterday, we did an exercise where all of us were in the middle of the room, and as we called out the names of groups that are historically out groups or down groups that have been the object of discrimination or exclusion, we asked that group to go to one side and everyone else to the other. And we called out, would all people of color go to one side? And of course, there was no one there, and all the rest of us were on one side. And that absence just spoke volumes. And it's certainly not just this community here at Holden that suffers from that lack or that absence. Peace and justice organizations tend to be, particularly peace organizations, tend to be very white dominated. And there's still these tremendous gaps in our understanding and our ability to relate to people other than ourselves. And we're cut off from these communities. So that's a very difficult one. I just couldn't believe I was a pastor in a Presbyterian congregation for 3 years, and we never had a person of color in a congregation of 1,100 people. It's like, what does that say about the gospel that we're living out, that it simply draws from one small group? That's a very difficult one. Well, let's move on from this. We want to come back to this again, because I think the original Franciscan community, as it was brought together and lived out its disciplines, is a tremendous source of inspiration and challenge to the contemporary church. To try to again, to return to our radical roots. And what we talked about yesterday is that radical is not out there on the fringe, but radical means returning to your roots, returning to the gospel message and hearing it once again, clearing off the blinders and the filters that have kept us from really hearing what's there and responding to it. And I think, as you pointed out, our class situation is one of the foremost blinders that helps us filter things through and kind of rewrite the gospel in ways that are much more comfortable to us yet.
When I think of Franciscan orders today, it seems to me they exemplify most of that. I'm wondering if they have been able to maintain number two, not the lay movement so much, but the lack of an authoritarian structure. Have they been able to do that? Does anybody know?
I think they were beginning to fall away from that even in the first first generation. I think that was the source of great controversy, and that there were leaders who got more and more power and influence over the course of the order.
It seems to me that as we look at that list, that may be the most difficult thing of all for any of us to do. As soon as groups of human beings form, there are certain strata, certain structure, certain authority, and with authority comes power, and I think that has implications for everything else. I mean, I think that is what makes societies the way they are, and even the Franciscans couldn't totally get away from it.
That's true. And I think that is very to the point that even with all of this, these characteristics, the Franciscan community was very much a human community, very fallible, struggling, experimenting, compromising, going forward, backing off. So we have to remember that and not create some kind of ideal out there that none of us could even approach. I want to bring this up and make this a little more contemporary, because I think the kind of renewal movement that was happening in the day of Francis within the larger the Church Universal is also happening in our time. And I see that first and foremost in Central America and Latin America in the base community movement. How many of you are at least somewhat familiar with the base communities? If you just raise your hand. I'd just like to kind of talk about the base communities for just a minute. I lived and worked in Nicaragua with Witness for Peace, and as a part of that experience, I was introduced to and got to experience a number of these base communities. These are small groups of Christians, men and women of faith, groups no larger than, say, 10 to 50, who gather together for Bible study and for prayer. They're largely Roman Catholic. They're largely drawn from lower income, poor people. Those who have been trying to organize base communities have not had much success in the middle class and among the rich. And they are largely lay-led. In fact, the whole base community, one of the reasons the base community movement came about, particularly in Central America, was a lack of priests, a lack of ordained clergy. And so, they have one priest for 5,000 parishioners in a large parish, which is just impossible. And so they began to train lay people to carry out some of the functions of the priest. And so these communities began to come together. And the other remarkable thing is that for Roman Catholics in Latin America, they were finally getting to work with Scripture. Whereas the Bible had always been kind of a sacred relic that the priests knew how, the priests could touch and no one else could read, even read. But through this base community movement and a process of literacy that paralleled that, people were beginning to experience the power of Scripture. And not in an abstract way, but in a very contextual way. People were asking questions of Scripture Like, what does it mean for us as the people of God to live out our faith in this very concrete, historic moment, confronted with the problems that we're confronted with, whether it might be alcoholism, landlessness, military repression, whatever it might be. The people were asking Scripture to respond in a kind of dialogue to the very concrete problems that they had and that they faced. And so biblical reflection became very contextual, grounded in the life experience of these small communities. The base community movement is so vast. There are literally thousands of them. In Brazil alone, I think, Lisa or Dan, I've heard as many as 100,000 base communities in Brazil alone. Now, they're all across Latin America, so any generalization I might make about them is really needs to be taken with a grain of salt because they are so diverse. But in general, there's a kind of evolution that these communities go through. And this was confirmed in my conversations and work with a Marianole sister in Nicaragua who showed us several communities in different stages of maturation. The initial communities often came together around, they were communities of worship. They would celebrate the Eucharist together, they would do biblical reflection, and that was their common point of reference. And that's where many of them began. Then, as these communities evolved and as one family or another family was pressed in by an urgent need, these communities became communities of mutual care and support so that they looked out for one another. They became kind of an extended family. Then as these communities began to continue to evolve and to mature, they began to learn how to analyze their reality. So that not just doing biblical reflection, but they were trying to analyze, why are we hungry? Why do we have no land? Why do we not have education in our district? They began to ask probing questions of their reality. So you had the power of this activated religious tradition and their scriptural reflection, and also an ingrowing analytical skill to ask questions. Why is the world the way it is? And so these communities began to mature and become communities of social change, actually out there confronting the systems that kept them hungry or kept them landless. And this was a very, very important step that many of them haven't yet made, but many of them have. From communities of worship, communities of mutual aid and support, communities of social change. And I think that this is a very, very important model for North Americans and the North American church. Even though our realities are vastly different, we are not primarily poor people. We are primarily middle-class people. We do not experience alienation from the system the way that these people have and do. We have other means of support. We don't have to really turn to each other. We have other systems that kind of keep us autonomous and independent so that we don't have to rely on each other for support yet. So they're vast differences, but I think they're important clues in the Franciscan communities and in the base communities of Central America that we need to be attentive to in the North American church. One of these is, I think, the thirst for community. I think that we are all so isolated and so in our busyness, and the amount of activity we are responsible for keeps us apart from one another. Even within the family unit, it seems like the time that we have together seems less and less and less. The thirst for community, I think, is pushing for a new way of being the church, a new way of experiencing community in the life of the church. Another thing is the whole issue for lay empowerment. This business of our clergy standing up in front of us and all of our congregations saying, there's the minister, there's where ministry is done. That cannot be any farther from the gospel and from the experience of the early church, where each of us found our own charism, our own gift for ministry, and that was named and blessed in the community. And we all knew that this is what I bring to the community. Rather than looking to the minister as the source of ministry, we all were nurtured to claim our own ministry. That's something that's happening in the Third World Church. It's something that's beginning to happen here in the United States. I'm kind of going with the momentum here. Let me just slow down a little bit, say if any of this, if you want to react to anything I say, just feel free to jump in. The other contribution I think the base communities can make to the life of the North American church is teaching us how to do contextual theology. We are so often debating castles in the air. We're talking about issues of orthodoxy, and we really reduce theological reflection to our debate over the classical Christian truths of doctrine, rather than allowing theology to be the guiding force behind our way of doing ministry and our relationship and our dialogue with our communities. That's where theology really takes on life, when it's connected to my own life experience and my need and my need to be about ministry, and the same with communities. So making theology contextual, I think, is an important contribution in the base communities. The other is that I think we are entering into a time of national crisis, and our church has a very important role to play in the next 50 years as we in this nation face a continuing loss of power and influence as a so-called empire. And I think the temptation for us as a nation will be more and more intervention, more and more attempts to control world affairs, and less ability to do so. I think the cost of that will be a more and more polarized situation here at home, and more people falling through the cracks. And I think that's just on one front, on the political global front. If we look at the ecological crisis, if we look at the economic crisis, I mean, the church has really got to get its act together, and to be an alternative community within the life of this nation, to show that justice can be done and peace can be lived out to a nation that's going to be in crisis. And I think only in community can we attempt to take on the challenges of this kind of prophetic ministry. It will be too overwhelming to attempt alone or in isolation. We have to be in community to be a part, to be about the kind of business that we need to be about in the coming years ahead. And it will be rough business. And unless we are together and supporting one another, we won't be up to it. So that's the promise I think that the base community model has for the North American church. And it's not something that's just happening in Central America. It's happening in North America too. I see all over the country people coming together, hungry for community, hungry for a deeper spiritual life, hungry for a sense of having their lives connected to something more than just themselves, to a deeper struggle for justice and peace in our land. And that's happening. But it's not necessarily happening in the church. It's in so many ways it's bypassing the institutional church. And that's what we need to be alarmed about, I think. Try to allow that to happen within our own traditions, within our own communities.
Stuart, I just had an observation about that. And what you're saying about the base communities makes me wonder, from a Catholic perspective, how, when you were listing the various aspects of St. Francis' philosophy and working within the church, and I just it seems like when you start working with base communities who are working contextually and really focusing on what this means to my group here,
How does that, I mean, how does that fit within the church? How is Rome, how is the Pope dealing with these base communities? I mean, it seems like you could get all sorts of different reactions.
Well, that's the interesting question. In Central America, the official church or the hierarchy has repressed the base communities and tried to drive them out of existence in some cases and co-opt their leadership in other cases and shut them down, just literally shut them down. And so there's been a real active repression in some sectors of the base communities. The incredible thing to me is that the base communities still cling to the church, still remain loyal to the church, and don't just become schismatic. In this country, I think we see support groups blossoming everywhere, new age groups, special groups like that respond to a particular need that are happening all over. And that's good. We shouldn't be trying to stop that anyway, but it's also indicating that the church is not meeting a very primary need for community.
But isn't the Vatican's refusal to accept the base community coming more out of the liberation theology, and that really speaks against what St. Francis says when St. Francis doesn't talk about, or at least my understanding of your peacemaking, liberation theology isn't talking peacemaking or pacifist, are they, in Central America? Isn't that where Vatican's having their trouble?
Well, liberation theology is also, there are many different liberation perspectives, and as there are liberation theologians. So there's no one thing that's liberation theology. The liberation theology was really born in the base communities. And it was simply men and women of faith trying to reflect on why is the world the way it is, and what is the will of God for our world and for ourselves living in this world. And it meant they had to confront, they had to try to liberate themselves from systems that oppress them. So in some cases there was a position on, you would have nonviolent communities and others not. Others have taken up armed struggle. But there's not one position that sums up liberation.
I mean, I didn't mean to put down either side. That there is that struggle, though, and that struggle is inherent in, I mean, she may have said the question over there made it sound like the Vatican was beating down. And just the way the whole system is number two up there, the Vatican has real trouble with that just because that's the way our church is set up.
Exactly.
I just wanted to add a point in here. The interesting thing, though, is that the Vatican has actually come out with two papers supporting liberation theology. And I think that's one of the kind of unknown things about the Pope, is that it was surprising for me to read these and actually hear what it was that they were looking for. And what they basically did was come out with like 10 or 12 qualifications, you know, basically the questions that you had. And one of them was, we cannot support armed struggle. But there was a whole other list. But basically, they did come out saying that they supported liberation theology and its basic tenet, which is that the church has a preferential option for the poor, which is a very surprising thing. You know, I don't think most people think of the Pope as being that way. Pope also came out and made a statement for modified socialism, which I think is another kind of...
Was that the Pope or the American bishops?
That was the Pope. Interesting. Same paper. I wish I could quote it. I could probably find it for you somewhere, but there were two major papers out on liberation theology as response to what was happening in Central America. So I do think there is some hope, and I think that's part of the reason that Central Americans have stayed with the church, is I think they've seen a movement toward. In Nicaragua especially, I think the real reason why they've been oppressed so much is the hierarchy question. More not wanting to give up the hierarchy and the authority that has been invested in the bishops and the priests, instead of what the actual theology is. Do you want to mention the Kairos document? There's also a copy of it in the Resource Center.
Yeah, there's been a series of documents that have been sent to the First World Church, the Church of Europe and the United States, from the Third World, our Third World brothers and sisters, based communities all over the Third World, in the Philippines and Latin America and Central America, in Korea, Namibia, and South Africa. And this is a statement saying that we address to us as people of faith, saying we are living in a moment of kairos, a moment of heightened possibility, a moment of judgment and grace, a decisive moment that requires that we respond, because the system of the world as it is killing thousands upon thousands of our brothers and sisters of faith. And we need to be reflecting on that and realizing that we have a tremendous investment in that same system. We're not intending for it to kill anyone, but it is the system, that's the same system that benefits us so greatly, is also the system that is creating such havoc in the lives of Christians all over the world. And they're saying, please be aware of this. Please, we need to dialogue about this. Very important statement called the Kairos document.
In addition to the South African Kairos document and the Resource Center, there's the Central American and the Road to Damascus, and also a paper calling Americans to study these documents, and an address that you can write to get in on a network of American Christian churches which are studying those documents, and calling for people to write to this committee with their responses in the hope of getting something together for the year 1992, for the 500th anniversary of Columbus Voyage.
Yes.
Going back to what you're saying about, you know, support groups and things, I guess, as I feel like your typical church in America is not, you know, reaching people's needs, because on a Sunday morning there's so many, you know, hurting people there, and there's a lot of deception that goes on, you know, as far as, you know, how are you, I'm fine. I mean, so many people say that, but there are a lot of issues in people's lives that are not being addressed by the church, and I think a lot of it has to do with point number one, from our, you know, the socioeconomic situation as far as being middle class. It always seems like that's kind of how you're taught, you know, how are you, I'm fine. You know, it's never, people aren't very honest about what's going on. I see that on Sunday mornings with people that I know that things are going on in their lives, but it's not addressed.
What you have done in the statement you made is what I had intended for all of us to be able to do, and I apologize that I got carried away with talking. I'd hoped that we would have had time in this hour to, in twos and threes, talk about our own experience of church and what in that is alienating to us and what in that is life-giving. And how do we begin to, with Francis, take our stones and start rebuilding the church piece by piece to overcome that which is just alienating and to nurture that which is life-giving. And that was probably the most important stuff we could have been doing in this hour, and I apologize that we did not get to that. But thank you very, very much for what we did get to do.